6 more coming at him. Instead, he saw the enemy fleeing for their lives into the mist. Riverwind, covered with blood, collapsed onto the ground.
"The lift!"
the mage pointed. It was hovering about 2 feet off the ground and starting to move upward. There were gully dwarves in the top pot coming down.
"Stop it!"
Sturm yelled. Tasselhoff raced from his hiding place and leaped for the edge. He clung, his feet dangling, trying desperately to keep the empty pot from rising.
"Caraman, hang on to it!"
Sturm ordered the warrior.
"I'll get Tanis." "I can hold it, but not for long,"
the big man grunted, grasping onto the edge and digging his feet into the ground. He dragged the lift to a halt. Tasselhoff climbed inside, hoping his small body might add ballast. Sturm ran back swiftly to Tanis. Flint was beside him, his axe in his hands.
"He's alive,"
the dwarf called as the knight approached. Sturm paused a moment to thank some god somewhere. Then he and Flint lifted the unconscious half-elf and carried him to the pot. They placed him inside, then returned for Riverwind. It took 4 of them to get Riverwind's bloody body into the lift. Tass tried without much success to stanch the wounds with one of his handkerchiefs.
"Hurry!"
Caraman gasped. Despite all his efforts, the pot was rising slowly.
"Get in!"
Sturm ordered Raistlin. The mage glanced at him coldly and ran back into the mist. Within moments, he reappeared, carrying Boo-Poo in his arms. The knight grabbed the trembling gully dwarf and flung her into the lift. Boo-Poo, whimpering, crouched on the bottom, still clutching her bag to her chest. Raistlin climbed over the side. The pot continued to rise. Caraman's arms were nearly pulled out of their sockets.
"Go on!"
Sturm ordered Caraman. The knight being the last to leave the field of battle as usual. Caraman knew better than to argue. He heaved himself up, nearly tipping the pot over. Flint and Raistlin dragged him in. Without Caraman holding it, the pot lunged upward rapidly. Sturm caught hold of it with both hands and clung to the side as it rose into the air. After 2 or 3 tries, he managed to swing a leg over the edge and climbed in with Caraman's help. The knight knelt down beside Tanis and was relieved beyond expression to see the half-elf stir and moan. Sturm grasped the half-elf and held him close.
"You have no idea how glad I am you're back,"
the knight said, his voice husky.
"Riverwind?"
Tanis murmured groggily.
"He's here. He saved your life. He saved all our lives."
Sturm talked rapidly, almost incoherently.
"We're in the lift, going up. The city's destroyed. Where are you hurt?"
"Broken ribs. Feels like."
Wincing in pain, Tanis looked over at Riverwind, still conscious despite his wounds.
"Poor man,"
Tanis said softly.
"Gold Moon. I saw her die, Sturm. There was nothing I could do."
Sturm helped the half-elf rise to his feet.
"We have the discs,"
the knight said firmly.
"It was what she wanted, what she fought for. They're in my pack. Are you sure you can stand?"
"Yes,"
Tanis said. He drew a ragged, painful breath.
"We have the discs. Whatever good that will do us."
They were interrupted by the shrill screams as the second pot, gully dwarves flying like banners, went past them. The gully dwarves shook their fists and cursed the companions. Boo-Poo laughed, then she stood up, looking at Raistlin in concern. The mage leaned wearily against the side of the pot, his lips moving silently, calling to mind another spell. Sturm peered up through the mist.
I wonder how many will be at the top, he asked.
Tanis, too, glanced up.
Most have fled, I hope, he said.
He caught his breath sharply and clutched at his ribs. There was a sudden lurch. The pot fell about a foot, stopped with a jolt, then slowly started to rise again. The companions looked at each other in alarm.
The mechanism. It's either starting to collapse or the Draconians have recognized us and are trying to destroy it, Tanis said.
There's nothing we can do,
Sturm said in bitter frustration. He stared down at the pack containing the disks, which lay at his feet.
Except pray to these gods.
The pot lurched and dropped again. For a moment it hung, suspended, swaying in the mist-shrouded air. Then it started up, moving slowly, shuddering. The companions could see the edge of the rock ledge and the opening above them. The pot rose inch by creaking inch, each of those inside mentally supporting every link of the chain that was carrying them up to...
Draconians! Cried Tass shrilly, pointing up.
Two Draconians stared down at them. As the pot crept closer and closer, Tanis saw the Draconians crouch, ready to jump.
They're going to leap down here! The pot won't hold!
Flint rumbled.
We'll crash!
That may be their intent, Tanis said. They have wings!
Stand back!
Raistlin said, staggering to his feet.
Raist, don't!
His brother caught hold of him.
You're too weak!
I have strength for one more spell.
The mage whispered.
But it may not work. If they see I am Magi, they may be able to resist my magic.
Hide behind Caraman's shield, Tanis said swiftly. The big man thrust his body and his shield in front of his brother. The mist swirled around them, concealing them from Draconian eyes, but also preventing them from seeing the Draconians.
The pot rose. Inch by inch, the chain creaking and lurching upward.
Raistlin stood poised behind Caraman's shield, his strange eyes staring, waiting for the mists to part. Cool air touched Tanis's cheek. A breeze swirled the mists apart just for an instant. The Draconians were so close they could have almost touched them. The Draconians saw them at the same time. One spread its wings and floated down toward the pot, sword in hand, shrieking in triumph. Raistlin spoke. Caraman moved his shield and the mage spread his thin fingers. A ball of white shot from his hands, hitting the Draconian squarely in the chest. The ball exploded, covering the creature in sticky webbing. Its cry of triumph changed to a horrifying shriek as the webbing tangled its wings. It plummeted into the mist, its body striking the edge of the iron pot as it fell. The pot began to rock and sway.
There's still one more!
Raistlin gasped, sinking to his knees.
Hold me up, Caraman. Help me stand.
The mage began to cough violently, blood trickling from his mouth.
Raist,
his brother pleaded, dropping his shield and catching his fainting twin.
Stop. There's nothing you can do. You'll kill yourself.
A look of command was enough. The warrior supported his brother as the mage began to speak again, the eerie-sounding language of magic. The remaining Draconian hesitated, still hearing the yells of its fallen companion. It knew the human was a magic user. It also knew that it could probably resist the magic. But this human facing it was like no human magic user it had ever encountered. The human's body seemed weak, practically to the point of death, but a strong aura of power surrounded him. The mage raised his hand, pointing at the creature. The draconian cast one last vicious glance at the companions, then turned and fled. Raistlin, unconscious, sank into his brother's arms as the pot completed its journey to the surface. Chapter 22. Boo Poo's Gift, an Ominous Sight. Just as they pulled Riverwind out of the lift, a sharp tremor shook the floor of the Hall of the Ancestors. The companions, dragging Riverwind with them, scrambled back as the floor cracked. The floor gave way and tumbled down, carrying the great wheel and the iron pots down into the mist below.
"This whole place is caving in!"
Caramon shouted in alarm, holding his brother in his arms.
"Run! Back to the Temple of Mishikal!"
Tanis gasped with pain.
"Trusting in the gods again, huh?"
Flint said. Tanis could not answer. Sturm took hold of Riverwind's arms and started to lift him, but the plainsman shook his head and shoved him away.
"My wounds are not serious. I can manage. Leave me."
He remained slumped on the shattered floor. Tanis glanced questioningly at Sturm. The knight shrugged. The Salamnic knights considered suicide noble and honorable. The elves considered it blasphemy. The half-elf took hold of the plainsman's long, dark hair and jerked his head back so that the startled man was forced to look into Tanis's eyes.
"Go ahead. Lie down and die,"
Tanis said through clenched teeth.
"Shame your chieftain. She at least had the courage to fight."
Riverwind's eyes smoldered. He caught hold of Tanis's wrist and flung the half-elf away from him with such force that Tanis staggered into the wall, groaning in agony. The plainsman stood up, staring at Tanis with hatred. Then he turned and stumbled down the shaking corridor, his head bent. Sturm helped Tanis to his feet, the half-elf dizzy from the pain. They followed the others as fast as they could, the floor tilted crazily. When Sturm slipped, they crashed against a wall. A sarcophagus slid out into the hallway, spilling its grisly contents. A skull rolled over by Tanis's feet, startling the half-elf, who fell to his knees. He feared he might faint from the pain.
"Go!"
he tried to say to Sturm, but he couldn't talk. The knight picked him up, and together they staggered on through the dust-choked corridor. At the foot of the stairs, called the Paths of the Dead, they found Tasselhoff waiting.
"The others?"
Sturm gasped, coughing in the dust.
"They've already gone up to the temple," Tasselhoff said. "Caramon told me to wait here for you. Flint says the temple's safe. Dwarven stonework, you know. Raistlin's conscious. He said it was safe, too. Something about being held in the palm of the goddess. Riverwind's there. He glared at me. I think he could have killed me. But he made it up the stairs."
"All right,"
Tanis said to stop the prattling. "Enough. Put me down, Sturm. I've got to rest a minute or I'll pass out. Take Tass and I'll meet you upstairs.
Go on, damn it."
Sturm grabbed Tasselhoff by the collar and dragged him upstairs. Tanis sank back. Sweat chilled his body. Every breath was agony. Suddenly, the remainder of the floor in the Hall of the Ancestors collapsed with a loud, snapping noise. The Temple of Mishikal trembled and shook. Tanis staggered to his feet, then he paused a moment. Faintly, behind him, he could now hear the low, thundering rumble of water surging. New Sea had claimed Zakht-Saroth. The city that was dead was now buried. Tanis emerged slowly from the stairwell into the circular room at the top. The climb had been a nightmare, each new step a miracle. The chamber was blessedly quiet. The only sound the harsh breathing of his friends, who had made it that far and collapsed. He too could go no farther. The half-elf glanced around to make certain the others were all right. Sturm had set down the pack containing the discs and was slumped against the wall. Raistlin lay on a bench, his eyes closed, his breathing quick and shallow. Of course, Karaman sat beside him, his face dark with anxiety. Tasselhoff sat at the bottom of the pedestal, staring up at the top. Flint leaned against the doors, too tired to grumble.
"Where's Riverwind?"
Tanis asked. He saw Karaman and Sturm exchange glances, then lower their eyes. Tanis staggered up, anger defeating his pain. Sturm rose and blocked his path.
"It's his decision, Tanis.
It is the way of his people as it is the way of mine." Tanis shoved the knight aside and walked toward the double doors. Flint did not move.
"Get out of my way,"
the half-elf said, his voice shaking. Flint looked up. The lines of grief and sorrow etched by 100 years softened the dwarf's scowling expression. Tanis saw in Flint's eyes the accumulated wisdom that had drawn an unhappy half-human, half-elven boy into a strange and lasting friendship with a dwarf.
"Sit down, lad,"
Flint said in a gentle voice, as if he too remembered their origins.
"If your elven head cannot understand, then listen to your human heart for once."
Tanis shut his eyes, tears stinging his lids. Then he heard a great cry from inside the temple. "Riverwind!" Tanis thrust the dwarf aside and pushed open the huge golden doors, striding rapidly, ignoring his pain. He threw open the second set of doors and entered the chamber of Mishikal. Once again he felt peace and tranquility flood over him, but now the feelings only added to his anger over what had happened.
"I cannot believe in you," Tanis cried. "What kind of gods are you that you demand a human sacrifice? You are the same gods who brought the cataclysm down on man. All right, so you're powerful. Now leave us alone. We don't need you."
The half-elf wept. Through his tears he could see that Riverwind, sword in hand, knelt before the statue. Tanis stumbled forward, hoping to prevent the act of self-destruction. Tanis rounded the base of the statue and stopped, stunned. For a minute, he refused to believe his own sense of sight. Perhaps grief and pain were playing tricks in his mind. He lifted his eyes to the statue's beautiful, calm face, and steadied his reeling, confused senses. Then he looked again. Gold Moon lay there, sound asleep, her breast rising and falling with the rhythm of her quiet breathing. Her silver gold hair had come loose from its braid and drifted around her face in the gentle wind that filled the chamber with the fragrance of spring. The staff was once again part of the marble statue, but Tanis saw that Gold Moon wore around her throat the necklace that had once adorned the statue.
"I am a true cleric now," Gold Moon said softly. "I am a disciple of Mishikal, and though I have much to learn, I have the power of my faith. Above all else, I am a healer. I bring the gift of healing back into the land."
Reaching out her hand, Gold Moon touched Tanis on the forehead, whispering a prayer to Mishikal. The half-elf felt peace and strength flow through his body, cleansing his spirit and healing his wounds.
"We've got a cleric now," Flint said. "And that'll come in handy. But from what we hear, this Lord Verminard's a cleric, too, and a powerful one at that.
We may have found the ancient gods of good, but he found the ancient gods of evil a lot sooner. I don't see how these disks are going to help much against hordes of dragons."
"You are right," Gold Moon said softly. "I am not a warrior. I am a healer. I do not have the power to unite the peoples of our world to fight this evil and restore the balance. My duty is to find the person who has the strength and the wisdom for this task. I am to give the disks of Mishikal to that person."
The companions were silent for long moments. Then,
"We must leave here, Tanis,"
Raistlin hissed from out of the shadows of the temple where he stood, staring out the door into the courtyard.
"Listen."
Horns. They could all hear the shrill braying of many, many horns carried on the north wind.
"The armies,"
said Tanis softly.
"War has begun."
The companions fled Zakhtzaroth into the twilight. They traveled west toward the mountains. The air was cold with the bite of early winter. Dead leaves, blown by chill winds, flew past their faces. They decided to head for Solace, planning to stock up on supplies and gather what information they could before determining where to go in their search for a leader. Tanis could foresee arguments along those lines. Already Sturm was talking of Solamnia. Gold Moon mentioned Haven, while Tanis himself was thinking the disks of Mishikal would be safest in the Elven Kingdom. Discussing vague plans, they traveled on well into the night. They saw no Draconians and supposed that those escaping Zakhtzaroth had traveled north to join up with the armies of this Lord Verminard, Dragon High Master. The silver moon rose, then the red. The companions climbed high, the sound of the horns driving them on past the point of exhaustion. They made camp on the summit of the mountain. After eating a cheerless supper, not daring to light a fire, they set the watch, then slept. Raistlin woke in the cold gray hour before dawn. He had heard something. Had he been dreaming? No. There it was again. The sound of someone crying. Gold Moon, the mage, thought irritably, and started to lie back down. Then he saw Bupu curled in a ball of misery, blubbering into a blanket. Raistlin glanced around. The others were asleep except for Flint, standing watch on the other side of camp. The dwarf had apparently heard nothing, and he wasn't looking in Raistlin's direction. The mage stood up and padded softly over. Kneeling down beside the gully dwarf, he laid his hand on her shoulder.
"What is it, little one?"
Bupu rolled over to face him. Her eyes were red, her nose swollen. Tears streaked down her dirty face. She snuffled and wiped her hand across her nose.
"I don't want to leave you. I want to go with you," she said brokenly. "But, oh, I will miss my people."
Sobbing, she buried her face in her hands. A look of infinite tenderness touched Raistlin's face, a look no one in his world would ever see. He reached out and stroked Bupu's coarse hair, knowing what it felt like to be weak and miserable, an object of ridicule and pity.
"Bupu," he said, "you have been a good and true friend to me. You saved my life and the lives of those I care about. Now you will do one last thing for me, little one. Go back. I must travel roads that will be dark and dangerous before the end of my long journey. I cannot ask you to go with me."
Bupu lifted her head, her eyes brightening. Then a shadow fell across her face,
but you will be unhappy without me.
No, Raceland said, smiling. My happiness will lie in knowing you are back with your people.
You sure?
Bupu asked anxiously.
I am sure,
Raceland answered.
Then I go.
Bupu stood up. But first you take gift. She began to rummage around in her bag.
No, little one.
Raceland began, remembering the dead lizard.
That's not necessary.
The words caught in his throat as he watched Bupu pull from her bag
a book.
He stared in amazement, seeing the pale light of the chill morning illuminate silver runes on a night-blue leather binding. Raceland reached out a trembling hand.
The spellbook of Fistan Dantalus,
he breathed.
You like?
Bupu said shyly.
Yes, little one.
Raceland took the precious object in his hands and held it lovingly, stroking the leather.
Where?
I take from dragon, Bupu said, when blue light shine. I glad you like. Now I go, find High Bulb Fudge the First, the Great.
She slung her bag over her shoulder. Then she stopped and turned.
That cough. You sure you not want lizard cure?
No. Thank you, little one.
Raceland said, rising. Bupu looked at him sadly, then, greatly daring, she caught his hands in hers and kissed it swiftly. She turned away, her head bowed, sobbing bitterly. Raceland stepped forward. He laid his hand on her head.
If I have any power at all, great one,
he said inside himself,
power that has not been revealed to me, grant that this little one goes through her life in safety and happiness. Farewell, Bupu,
he said softly. She stared at him with wide, adoring eyes, then turned and ran off as fast as her floppy shoes would carry her.
What was that all about?
Flint said, stumping over from the other side of the camp.
Oh,
he added, seeing Bupu running off.
So you got rid of your pet gully dwarf.
Raceland did not answer, but simply stared at Flint with a malevolence that made the dwarf shiver and walk hurriedly away. The mage held the spellbook in his hands, admiring it. He longed to open it and revel in its treasures, but he knew that long weeks of study lay ahead of him before he could even read the new spells, much less acquire them. And with the spells would come more power. He sighed in ecstasy and hugged the book to his thin chest. Then he slipped it swiftly into his pack with his own spellbook. The others would be walking soon. Let them wonder how he got the book. Raceland stood up, glancing out to the west, to his homeland, where the sky was brightening with the early morning sun. Suddenly he stiffened. Then, dropping his pack, he ran across the camp and knelt down beside the half-elf.
Tanis!
Raceland hissed.
Wake up!
Tanis woke and grabbed his dagger.
What?
Raceland pointed to the west. Tanis blinked, trying to focus his sleep-scummed eyes. The view from the top of the mountain where they were camped was magnificent. He could see the tall trees give way to the grassy plains, and beyond the plains, snaking up into the sky.
No!
Tanis choked. He gripped the mage.
No, it can't be.
Yes,
Raceland whispered.
Solace is burning.
Book 2 Chapter 1 Night of the Dragons. Tico wrung the rag out in the pail and watched, dully, as the water turned black. She threw the rag down on the bar and started to lift the bucket to carry it back to the kitchen to draw more water. Then she thought, why bother? Picking up the rag, she began to mop the tables again. When she thought Otik wasn't watching, she wiped her eyes with her apron. But Otik was watching. His pudgy hands took hold of Tika's shoulders and gently turned her around. Tika gave a choking sob and laid her head on his shoulder.
I'm sorry, Tika sobbed, but I can't get this clean.
Otik knew, of course, that this wasn't the real reason the girl was weeping, but it came close. He patted her back, gently.
I know, child. Don't cry, I understand.
It's this damn soot, Tika wailed. It covers everything with black, and every day I scrub it up, and the next day it's back. They keep burning and burning.
Don't worry about it, Tika, Otik said, stroking her hair. Be thankful the inn's in one piece.
Be thankful?
Tika pushed away from him, her face flushed.
No, I wish it had burned like everything else in Solace. Then they wouldn't come in here. I wish it had burned. I wish it had burned.
Tika sank down at the table, sobbing uncontrollably. Otik hovered around her.
I know, my dear, I know,
he repeated, smoothing the puffy sleeves of the blouse Tika had taken such pride in keeping clean and white. Now it was dingy and covered with soot, like everything in the ravaged town. The attack on Solace had come without warning. Even when the first pitiable refugees began to trickle into the town from the north, telling horror stories of huge, winged monsters, Hedrick, the High Theocrat, assured the people of Solace that they were safe, their town would be spared, and the people believed him, because they wanted to believe him. And then came the Night of the Dragons. The inn was crowded that night. One of the few places people could go and not be reminded of the storm clouds hanging low in the northern skies. The fire burned brightly, the ale was rich, the spiced potatoes were delicious, yet even here the outside world intruded, everyone talked loudly and fearfully of war. Hedrick's words soothed their fearful hearts.
We are not like these reckless fools to the north, who made the mistake of defying the might of the Dragon High Lords.
He called out, standing on a chair to be heard.
Lord Verminard has personally assured the Council of High Seekers in Haven that he wants only peace. He seeks permission to move his armies through our town so that he may conquer the Elflands to the south, and I say, more power to him!
Hedrick paused for scattered cheering and applause.
We have tolerated the elves in Qualanesti too long. I say let this Verminard drive them back to Sylvanost or wherever they came from. In fact,
Hedrick warmed to his subject,
some of you young men might consider joining the armies of this great lord, and he is a great lord. I have met him. He is a true cleric. I have seen the miracles he has performed. We will enter a new age under his leadership. We will drive the elves, dwarves, and other foreigners from our land, and...
There came a low, dull, roaring sound, like the gathering of the waters of a mighty ocean. Silence fell abruptly. Everyone listened, puzzled, trying to figure out what might make such a noise. Hedrick, aware that he had lost his audience, glanced around in irritation. The roaring sound grew louder and louder, coming closer. Suddenly, The inn was plunged into thick, smothering darkness. A few people screamed. Most ran for the windows, trying to peer out the few clear panes scattered among the colored glass.
"Go down and find out what's going on,"
someone said.
"It's so blasted dark I can't see the stairs,"
someone else muttered. And then it was no longer dark. Flames exploded outside the inn. A wave of heat hit the building with force enough to shatter windows, showering those inside with glass. The mighty Valenwood tree, which no storm on Kryn had ever stirred, began to sway and rock from the blast. The inn tilted. Tables scooted sideways, benches slid down the floor to slam up against the wall. Hedrick lost his balance and tumbled off his chair. Hot coals spewed from the fireplace as oil lamps from the ceiling and candles from the tables started small fires. A high-pitched shriek rose above the noise and confusion, the scream of some living creature, a scream filled with hatred and cruelty. The roaring noise passed over the inn. There was a rush of wind, then the darkness lifted, as a wall of flame sprang up to the south. Tika dropped a tray of mugs to the floor as she grabbed desperately at the bar for support. People around her shouted and screamed, some in pain, some with terror. Solace was burning. A lurid orange glow lit the room. Clouds of black smoke rolled in through the broken windows. Smells of blazing wood filled Tika's nostrils, along with a more horrible smell, the smell of burnt flesh. Tika choked and looked up to see small flames licking the great limbs of the Valenwood that held up the ceiling. Sounds of varnish sizzling and popping in the heat mingled with the screams of the injured.
"Douse those fires!"
Otik was yelling wildly.
"The kitchen!"
the cook screamed as she flew out of the swinging doors, her clothes smoldering, a solid wall of flame behind her. Tika grabbed a pitcher of ale from the bar and tossed it on the cook's dress and held her still to drench her clothes. Rhea sank into a chair, weeping hysterically.
"Get out! The whole place'll go up!"
someone shouted. Hedrick, pushing past the injured, was one of the first to reach the door. He ran onto the inn's front landing, then stopped, stunned, and gripped the rail for support. Staring northward, he saw the woods blazing, and by the ghastly light of the flames he could see hundreds of marching creatures, the lurid firelight reflecting off their leathery wings. Draconian ground troops! He watched, horrified, as the front ranks poured into the City of Solace, knowing there must be thousands more behind them, and above them flew creatures out of the stories of children. Dragons! 5 red dragons wheeled overhead in the flame-lit sky. First one, then another, dove down, incinerating parts of the small town with its fiery breath, casting the thick, magical darkness. It was impossible to fight them. Warriors could not see well enough to aim their arrows or strike with their swords. The rest of the night blurred in Tika's memory. She kept telling herself she must leave the burning inn, yet the inn was her home. She felt safe there, and so she stayed, though the heat from the flaming kitchen grew so intense it hurt her lungs to breathe. Just when the flames spread to the common room, the kitchen crashed to the ground. Otik and the barmaids flung buckets of ale on the flames in the common room until finally the fire was extinguished. Once the fire was out, Tika turned her attention to the wounded. Otik collapsed in a corner, shaking and sobbing. Tika sent one of the other barmaids to tend to him while she began treating the injured. She worked for hours, resolutely refusing to look out of the windows, blocking from her mind the awful sounds of death and destruction outside. Suddenly, it occurred to her that there was no end to the wounded, that more people were lying on the floor than had been in the inn when it was attacked. Dazed, she looked up to see people straggling in. Wives helped their husbands. Husbands carried their wives. Mothers carried dying children. "What's going on?" Tika asked a seeker guard who staggered in, clutching his arm where an arrow had penetrated it. Others pushed behind him. "What's happening? Why are these people coming here?" The guard looked at her with dull, pain-filled eyes.
"This is the only building," he mumbled. "All burning. All... no."
Tika went limp with shock, and her knees trembled. At that moment, the guard fainted in her arms, and she was forced to pull herself together. The last thing she saw as she dragged him inside was Hedrick, standing on the porch, staring out over the flaming town with glazed eyes. Tears streamed unheeded down his soot-streaked face.
"There's been a mistake," he whimpered, wringing his hands. "There's been a mistake made somewhere."
That had been a week ago. As it turned out, the inn was not the only building left standing. The Draconians knew which buildings were essential to their needs and destroyed all those that were not. The inn, Pharaoh Seinfeld's blacksmith shop, and the general store were saved. The blacksmith shop had always been on the ground because of the inadvisability of having the hot forge located in a tree, but the others had to be lowered to the ground because the Draconians found it difficult to get into the trees. Lord Verminard ordered the dragons to lower the buildings. After a space had been scorched clear, one of the huge red monsters stuck his claws into the inn and lifted it. The Draconians cheered as the dragon dropped it, not gently, onto the blackened grass. Fewmaster Turda, in charge of the town, ordered Otik to repair the inn immediately. The Draconians had one great weakness, a thirst for strong drink. 3 days after the town was taken, the inn reopened.
"I'm all right now," Tika told Otik.
She sat up and dried her eyes, wiping her nose with her apron.
"I haven't cried once since that night," she said, more to herself than to him.
Her lips tightened into a thin line.
"And I'll never cry again,"
she swore, rising from the table. Otik, not understanding but thankful that Tika had regained her composure before the patrons arrived, bustled back behind the bar.
"Nearly opening time," he said, trying to sound cheerful. "Maybe we'll have a good crowd today."
"How can you take their money?"
Tika flared. Otik, fearing another outburst, looked at her pleadingly.
"Their money is as good as anyone else's. Better than most these days," he said.
"Humph!"
Tika snorted. Her thick red curls quivered as she stalked angrily across the floor. Otik, knowing her temper, stepped backward. It didn't help. He was caught. She jabbed her finger into his fat stomach.
"How can you laugh at their crude jokes and cater to their whims?" she demanded. "I hate the stench of them. I hate their leers and their cold, scaly hands touching mine. Some day I'll—"
"Tika, please,"
Otik begged.
"Have some regard for me. I'm too old to be carried off to the slave mines, and you— they'd take you tomorrow if you didn't work here. Please behave. There's a good girl."
Tika bit her lip in anger and frustration. She knew Otik was right. She risked more than being sent off in the slave caravans that passed through town almost daily. An angered Draconian killed swiftly and without mercy. Just as she was thinking this, the door banged open and 6 Draconian guards swaggered in. One of them pulled the closed sign off the door and tossed it into a corner.
"You're open,"
the creature said, dropping into a chair.
Yes, certainly.
Otik grinned, weakly.
Tika?
I see them,
Tika said, dully. Chapter 2. The Stranger, Captured. The crowd at the inn that night was sparse. The patrons were now Draconians, though occasionally Solus residents came in for a drink. They generally did not stay long, finding the company unpleasant, and memories of former times hard to bear. Tonight, there was a group of hobgoblins who kept wary eyes on the Draconians, and three crudely dressed humans from the north. Originally impressed into Lord Verminard's service, they now fought for the sheer pleasure of killing and looting. A few Solus citizens sat huddled in a corner. Hedrick the Theocrat was not in his nightly spot. Lord Verminard had rewarded the High Theocrat's service by placing him among the first to be sent to the slave mines. Near dusk, a stranger entered the inn, taking a table in a dark corner near the door. Tika couldn't tell much about him. He was heavily cloaked and wore a hood pulled low over his head. He seemed fatigued, sinking down into his chair as though his legs would not support him.
"What will you have?"
Tika asked the stranger. The man lowered his head, pulling down one side of his hood with a slender hand.
"Nothing, thank you,"
he said in a soft, accented voice.
"Is it permissible to sit here and rest? I'm supposed to meet someone."
"How about a glass of ale while you wait?"
Tika smiled. The man glanced up, and she saw brown eyes flash from the depths of his hood.
"Very well,"
the stranger said.
"I am thirsty. Bring me your ale."
Tika headed for the bar. As she drew the ale, she heard more customers entering the inn.
"Just a half second,"
she called out, unable to turn around.
"Sit anywhere you've a mind. I'll be with you as soon as I can."
She glanced over her shoulder at the newcomers and nearly dropped the mug. Tika gasped, then got a grip on herself.
"Don't give them away."
"Sit down anywhere, strangers,"
she said loudly. One of the men, a big fellow, seemed about to speak. Tika frowned fiercely at him and shook her head. Her eyes shifted to the Draconians, seated in the center of the room. A bearded man led the group past the Draconians, who examined the strangers with a great deal of interest. They saw four men and a woman, a dwarf and a kender. The men were dressed in mud-stained cloaks and boots. One was unusually tall, another unusually big. The woman was cloaked in furs and walked with her hand through the arm of the tall man. All of them seemed downcast and tired. One of the men coughed and leaned heavily upon a strange-looking staff. They crossed the room and sat down at a table in the far corner.
"More refugee scum,"
sneered a Draconian.
"The humans look healthy, though, and all know dwarves are hard workers. Wonder why they haven't been shipped out. They will be soon as the Fewmaster sees them."
"Perhaps we should take care of the matter now,"
said a third, scowling in the direction of the eight strangers.
"No, I'm off duty. They won't go far."
The others laughed and returned to their drinking. A number of empty glasses already sat before each of them. Tika carried the ale to the brown-eyed stranger, set it before him hurriedly, then bustled back to the newcomers.
"What'll you have?"
she asked coldly. The tall, bearded man answered in a low, husky voice.
"Ale and food,"
he said,
"and wine for him.
He nodded at the man who was coughing almost continually. The frail man shook his head.
"Hot water,"
he whispered. Tika nodded and left. Out of habit, she started back toward where the old kitchen had been, then, remembering it was gone, she whipped around and headed for the makeshift kitchen that had been built by goblins under draconian supervision. Once inside, she astounded the cook by grabbing the entire skillet of fried spiced potatoes and carrying it back out into the common room.
"Ale all around and a mug of hot water," she called to Desra behind the bar.
Tika blessed her stars that Otik had gone home early.
"Itram, take a table,"
she motioned to the hobgoblins as she hurried back to the newcomers. She slammed the skillet down, glancing at the draconians. Seeing them absorbed in their drinking, she suddenly flung her arms around the big man and gave him a kiss that made him flush.
"Oh, Caraman," she whispered swiftly, "I knew you'd come back for me. Take me with you, please, please."
"Now there, there,"
Caraman said, patting her awkwardly on the back and looking pleadingly at Tanis. The half-elf swiftly intervened, his eyes on the draconians.
"Tika, calm down," he told her. "We've got an audience."
"Right,"
she said briskly, and stood up, smoothing her apron. Handing plates around, she began to ladle out the spiced potatoes as Desra brought the ale and hot water.
"Tell us, what happened to Solis?"
Tanis said. His voice choked. Quickly, Tika whispered the story as she filled everyone's plate, giving Caraman a double portion. The companions listened in grim silence.
"And so," Tika concluded, "every week the slave caravans leave for Pax Tharkas. Except now they've taken almost everyone, leaving only the skilled like Theros Ironfeld behind. I fear for him."
She lowered her voice.
"He swore to me last night that he would work for them no more. It all started with that captive party of elves."
"Elves? What are elves doing here?"
Tanis asked, speaking too loudly in his astonishment. The draconians turned to stare at him. The hooded stranger in the corner raised his head. Tanis hunched down and waited until the draconians turned their attention to their drinks. Then he started to ask Tika more about the elves. At that moment, a draconian yelled for ale. Tika sighed.
"I better go." She set the skillet down. "I'll leave that here. Finish them off."
The companions ate listlessly, the food tasting like ashes. Raistlin mixed his strange herbal brew and drank it down. His cough improved almost immediately. Caraman watched Tika as he ate, his expression thoughtful. He could still feel the warmth of her body as she had embraced him, and the softness of her lips. Pleasant sensations flowed through him, and he wondered if the stories he had heard about Tika were true. The thought both saddened him and made him angry. One of the draconians raised its voice.
"We may not be men like you're accustomed to, sweetie,"
it said drunkenly, flinging its scaled arm around Tika's waist,
"but that doesn't mean we can't find ways of making you happy."
Caraman rumbled deep in his chest. Sturm, overhearing, glowered and put his hand on his sword. Catching hold of the knight's arm, Tanis said urgently,
"Both of you, stop it. We're in an occupied town. Be sensible. This is no time for chivalry. You too, Caraman."
"Tika can handle herself." Sure enough, Tika slipped deftly out of the draconian's grip and flounced angrily into the kitchen.
"Well, what do we do now?" Flint grumbled. "We came back to Solis for supplies and find nothing but draconians. My house is little more than a cinder. Tanis doesn't even have a Valenwood tree, much less a home. All we've got are platinum discs of some ancient goddess and a sick mage with a few new spells."
He ignored Raistlin's glower.
"We can't eat the discs, and the magician hasn't learned to conjure up food, so even if we knew where to go, we'd starve before we got there."
"Should we still go to Haven?" Gold Moon asked, looking up at Tanis. "What if it is as bad as this? How do we know the High Seeker Council is even in existence?" "I don't have the answers," Tanis said, sighing. He rubbed his eyes with his hand. "But I think we should try to reach Qualinesti."
Tasselhoff, bored by the conversation, yawned and leaned back in his chair. It didn't matter to him where they went. Examining the inn with intense interest, he wanted to get up and look where the kitchen had burned, but Tanis had warned him before they entered to stay out of trouble. The kender contented himself with studying the other customers. He immediately noticed the hooded and cloaked stranger in the front of the inn, watching them intently as the conversation among the companions grew heated. Tanis raised his voice, and the word Qualinesti rang out again. The stranger set down his mug of ale with a thud. Tass was just about to call Tanis's attention to this when Tika came out of the kitchen and slammed food down in front of the Draconians, skillfully avoiding their clawed hands. Then she walked back over to the group.
"Could I have some more potatoes?" Karaman asked.
"Of course."
Tika smiled at him and picked up the skillet to return to the kitchen. Karaman felt Raistlin's eyes on him. He flushed and began to play with his fork.
"In Qualinesti," Tanis reiterated, his voice rising as he contested a point with Sturm, who wanted to go north.
Tass saw the stranger in the corner rise and start walking toward them.
"Tanis, company?"
the kinder said softly. The conversation ceased. Their eyes on their tankards, all of them could feel and hear the approach of the stranger. Tanis cursed himself for not noticing him sooner. The Draconians, however, had noticed the stranger. Just as he reached the creature's table, one of the Draconians stuck out its clawed foot. The stranger tripped over it, stumbling headlong into a nearby table. The creatures laughed loudly. Then a Draconian caught a glimpse of the stranger's face.
"Elf!"
the Draconian hissed, pulling off the hood to reveal the almond-shaped eyes, slanted ears, and delicate, masculine features of an elf lord.
"Let me pass,"
the elf said, backing up, his hands raised.
"I was only going to exchange a word of greeting with these travelers."
"You'll exchange a word of greeting with the Fewmaster elf,"
the Draconian snarled. Jumping up and grabbing the stranger's cloak collar, the creature shoved the elf back up against the bar. The other two Draconians laughed loudly. Tika, on her way back to the kitchen with the skillet, stalked over toward the Draconians.
"Stop this!"
she cried, taking hold of one of the Draconians by the arm.
"Leave him alone! He's a paying customer, same as you!"
"Go about your business, girl!"
the Draconian shoved Tika aside, then grabbed the elf with a clawed hand and hit him, twice, across the face. The blows drew blood. When the Draconian let go, the elf staggered, shook his head groggily.
"Oh, kill him!" shouted one of the humans from the north. "Make him screech like the others!"
"I'll cut his slanty eyes out of his head, that's what I'll do!"
the Draconian drew his sword.
"This has gone far enough."
Sturm rushed forward, the others behind him, though all feared there was little hope of saving the elf. They were too far from him. But help was closer. With a shrill cry of rage, Tico Whalen brought her heavy iron skillet down on the Draconian's head. There was a loud, clunking sound. The Draconian stared stupidly at Tika for an instant, then slithered to the floor. The elf jumped forward, drawing a knife as the other two Draconians leaped for Tika. Sturm reached her side and clubbed one of the Draconians with his sword. Karaman caught the other up in his great arms and tossed it over the bar.
Riverwind, don't let them out the door! Tanis cried, seeing the hobgoblins leap up. The plainsman caught one hobgoblin as it put its hand on the doorknob, but another escaped his grasp. They could hear it shouting for the guard. Tika, still wielding her skillet, thunked a hobgoblin over the head, but another hobgoblin, seeing Karaman charge over, leaped out of the window. Gold Moon rose to her feet.
"Use your magic,"
she said to Raistlin, grabbing him by the arm. "Do something." The mage looked at the woman coldly.
"It is hopeless,"
he whispered.
"I will not waste my strength."
Gold Moon glared at him in fury, but he had returned to his drink. Biting her lip, she ran over to Riverwind, the pouch with the precious discs of Mishikal in her arms. She could hear horns blowing wildly in the streets.
"We've got to get out of here,"
Tanis said. But at that moment, one of the human fighters wrapped his arms around Tanis's neck, dragging him to the floor. Tasselhoff, with a wild shout, leaped onto the bar and began flinging mugs at the half-elf's attacker, narrowly missing Tanis in the process. Flint stood in the midst of the chaos, staring at the elven stranger.
"I know you,"
he yelled suddenly.
"Tanis, isn't this—"
A mug hit the dwarf in the head, knocking him cold.
"Oops,"
said Tass. Tanis throttled the northerner and left him unconscious under a table. He grabbed Tass off the bar, set the kinder on the floor, and knelt down beside Flint, who was groaning and trying to sit up.
"Tanis, that elf!"
Flint blinked groggily, then asked,
"What hit me?"
"That big guy under the table,"
Tass said, pointing. Tanis stood up and looked at the elf Flint indicated.
"Gilthanas?"
The elf stared at him.
"Tantalas," he said coldly. "I would never have recognized you. That beard."
Horns blew again, this time closer.
"Great reorks,"
the dwarf groaned, staggering to his feet.
"We've got to get out of here. Come on, out the back."
"There is no back,"
Tika cried wildly, still hanging on to the skillet.
"No," said a voice at the door. "There is no back. You are my prisoners."
A blaze of torchlight flared into the room. The companions shielded their eyes, making out the forms of hobgoblins behind a squat figure in the doorway. The companions could hear the sounds of flapping feet outside, then what seemed like 100 goblins stared into the windows and peered in through the door. The hobgoblins inside the bar that were still alive or conscious picked themselves up and drew their weapons, regarding the companions hungrily.
"Sturm, don't be a fool,"
Tanis cried, catching hold of the knight as he prepared to charge into the seething mass of goblins slowly forming a ring of steel around them.
"We surrender,"
the half-elf called out. Sturm glared at the half-elf in anger, and for a moment Tanis thought he might disobey.
"Please, Sturm,"
Tanis said quietly.
"Trust me.
This is not our time to die."
Sturm hesitated, glanced around at the goblins crowding inside the inn. They stood back, fearful of his sword and his skill, but he knew they would charge in a rush if he made the slightest move.
"It is not our time to die."
What odd words! Why had Tanis said them? Did a man ever have a time to die? If so, Sturm realized this wasn't it, not if he could help it. There was no glory dying in an inn trampled by stinking, flapping goblin feet. Seeing the knight put his weapon away, the figure at the door decided it was safe to enter, surrounded as he was by 100 or so loyal troops. The companions saw the gray, mottled skin and red, squinting pig eyes of Fewmaster Turda.
Tasselhoff gulped and moved quickly to stand beside Tanis.
"Surely he won't recognize us,"
Tass whispered.
"It was dusk when they stopped us, asking about the staff."
Apparently, Turda did not recognize them. A lot had happened in a week's time, and the Fewmaster had important things stuffed in a mind already overloaded, his red eyes focused on the knight's emblems beneath Sturm's cloak.
"More refugee scum from Solania," Turda remarked.
"Yes," Tanis lied quickly. He doubted if Turda knew of the destruction of Zakhtzaroth. He thought it highly unlikely that this Fewmaster would know anything about the disks of Mishikal, but Lord Verminard knew of the disks, and he would soon learn of the dragon's death. Even a gully dwarf could add that one up. "No one must know they came out of the east. We have journeyed long days from the north. We did not intend to cause trouble. These Draconians started it."
"Yes, yes,"
Turda said impatiently.
"I've heard this before."
His squinty eyes suddenly narrowed.
"Hey, you!"
he shouted, pointing at Raistlin.
"What are you doing? Skulking back there. Fetch him, lads!"
The Fewmaster took a nervous step behind the door, watching Raistlin warily. Several goblins charged back, overturning benches and tables to reach the frail young man. Caramon rumbled deep in his chest. Tanis